the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
God raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly realms, far above all rule and authority, power and dominion, and every name that can be invoked, not only in the present age, but also in the one to come. And God placed all things under his feet and appointed him to be head over everything for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills everything in every way. That's one of the background readings to this morning's topic. If you want to get one of the green Bibles in front of you, we'll read the two others together. And I want to read some verses that not only talk about the power that Jesus has, as that last reading did, but also the way that power should be used in our world. So, we're going to go to Luke chapter 6, first of all, which is page 976. So, page 976, Luke chapter 6, and verse 27. And we're breaking into the middle of a sermon that Jesus once preached. Right, let's read that passage, shall we? But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who ill-treat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not withhold your shirt. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies. Do good to them. And lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. And we'll read just a little bit more, and this time it will be from Matthew chapter 22. And that's on page 937. Matthew 22 and verse 15. It says this: Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap Jesus in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, whose image is this? And whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. When they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him and went away. That's all we're going to read, and we're not going to go into those passages in any depth. There'll just be a backdrop to what we're saying this morning. We're going into a short series which talks about how Jesus might talk if he were walking the earth today to some of the most powerful, successful, whatever, people around. And we're starting with the most powerful, which is why Mrs. Trump and Putin have their pictures up there. What would Jesus say to the most powerful? I want to talk about four things this morning. First of all, what was Jesus' attitude to power in the first place? That emerges from some of the passages that we've read and other things that we'll refer to. Second, what would you say to Donald Trump? Third, what would you say to Vladimir Putin? Let's not leave anybody out this morning. And then fourth and finally, what does all of this say to us? That's all I want to say. So what was Jesus' attitude to power in the first place? Clearly, Jesus claimed, and his followers claimed for him, that he had awesome and immense power. Ephesians chapter 1 talks about that, doesn't it? The power that God showed by bringing Jesus back through the resurrection and putting him at his right hand, somebody who was just a dead man, a corpse in a grave the day before, suddenly there he is running the universe. And yet, what Jesus says about power, although it assumes his own power and his own glory, is often very disarming. And it seems to come down to, if you've got power, give it away. Some people have thought that Jesus has no real interest in earthly power because of something he said. My kingdom is not of this world. And so they tend to think, oh, Jesus is about religion and singing hymns and that sort of stuff. But he's not really concerned about where I cast my vote or what I think or do politically. And that's just wrong, as we've started to realize, I think, in the church over the last half century. Jesus, in fact, wants to prepare us for living in this world in every possible way. And that includes the way we relate to the powers around us. Because the problem is, you see, that unless our minds are shaped by his radical, revolutionary, upside-down kingdom kind of thinking, we tend to drift into being just the same as other people around us. Back in 1972, a long time ago now, there was a very seminal book written by a man called John Howard Yoder in America. And it was called The Politics of Jesus. And Yoder pointed out in that book that when Jesus was there in his day in Israel, there were three different political streams going on. There were the Pharisees, and they were the people who wanted everybody to observe the law, and if they didn't observe the law, they weren't very happy. There were the Sadducees, and they were kind of like religious liberals because they didn't believe in lots of things that the Pharisees believed in. The Pharisees believed in resurrection, the Sadducees didn't. The Sadducees thought if you're going to do anything with yourself, you're going to do it in this life. You get one life, and unless you take all your chances with both hands, nothing happens. And so the Sadducees were the ambitious ones. That's why they were always in the positions of power. Annas and Caiaphas, the high priests, they were jockeying for power with the Romans, and they were Sadducees. The Pharisees tended not to get to the top positions because the Sadducees were pragmatists. They were people who didn't mind getting their hands dirty, working with the Romans. They just wanted to make it work because once they were dead, they were dead. There were also the Zealots who went round at night stabbing people in the back. And they were the radicals. They were the revolutionaries. They believed that nothing good would happen in their country until the Roman Empire was thrown out. It was a pretty forlorn hope, but revolutionary armies, guerrilla forces all over the world tend to think like that, don't they? If we can just unsettle the peace, do a few terrorist actions here or there, you never know what might happen if people start to panic. So you've got three different kinds of approach there. And Yoder says in his book, Jesus was having none of any of them. There were the Pharisees who were kind of half-engaged conservatives. They weren't really that interested in power and politics until some issue came up that was concerned to religion that they were interested in. And then suddenly they got involved. And this is a danger that Christians face today, isn't it? That we can be kind of half engaged. We don't do the serious hard work of thinking through every issue we vote on. But when somebody talks about something that tramples on our toes, abortion, homosexuality, Christian rights, or whatever, suddenly we're right in there. You can't be selective. And one of the things that Jesus criticized the Pharisees for was the fact that they put laws on people. They made all sorts of regulations about how people should live their lives, but they wouldn't lift a finger to help them. And that's often what a Pharisaical approach does. It gets involved in this. We must do this. The law must do this. We must conserve this. We must save that. Not thinking what chaos they're causing in ordinary people's lives as a result. Then there were the Sadducees, the intensely involved ones. They were the careerists. They were the ones who were ambitious. And because of that, they were prepared to cut corners. They were prepared to do anything to stay in power. There was no reason, according to the rules, that Caiaphas and Annas should be in that position of power. They were breaking the rules to get there, but that didn't matter to them. They were hard-nosed, go-for-it kind of people. And we can easily be like that as well. We can make alliances with folks that we shouldn't in order to see our guy get into power. I don't want to get political and talk about the decisions that have been made. But one of the things that's been pointed out about the Republican Party and their support for Donald Trump is that just 2 years ago, some of the major figures who now support him were saying that this guy's unfaithful to his wife. This guy doesn't care about the poor. This guy doesn't stand for anything the Republicans stand for. But for some of them, the fact that he was promising success, and he sounded a bit like a conservative, and there was a wave of support behind him, that was enough. And so they supported someone whom just a very short while earlier they said, oh, he's a bad smell, we'll never have him as president. They turned round and went with him anyway, because it was one route to power. Then you've got people who are revolutionaries. And Christians are not terrorists. Christians don't try to upset the government of the country that they live in. Read Romans chapter 13, which talks about honouring the king, doing what the law suggests, and as far as you possibly can, while you're obeying God, obeying the laws of the country you're in. Do you know when that was written? Nero was on the throne. Nero, who a couple of years after those words were written, would be blaming the fire in Rome on the Christians, hauling them in their hundreds, covering them in tar, and setting them alight as torches to light up the city of Rome at night. Nero, who was unstable, who was lunatic, who was showing signs of insanity and criminal psychopathic tendencies at the point when Paul was writing, and Paul says, never mind, he's the king. God's put him in that position. Follow him as far as you can. Don't let your allegiance to God be threatened by what you're doing, but you don't upset the government. You don't say, this is evil, and therefore we've got to fight. We've got to derail trains, of which there are none for the next 200,000 years. But anyway, we've got to stab people in the back in alleyways. We've got to it's plant bombs. It's not that kind of world. It's not that kind of reaction that Christians have. So, says Yoda, what kind of reaction should Christians have? How does Jesus see us using power? And how did he use it himself? And he makes two points. This is my phrase, not his. But I think he says two things that are obviously true about Jesus' use of power. And they come across, I think, from the readings that we've already looked at this morning. First of all, there was an element of surprise in it. It was radically different from what anybody else would do. Love your enemies. Lend to people who ask from you. Give without asking for a receipt. Just be people of generosity. Think the best of people and live your life in a surprising, crazy way that makes absolutely no sense unless there is a God who is able to repay you when other people don't. A life that's radically different. And the second point, said Yoda, was it's a life that's radically dependent, because everything depends upon the goodness of God. And when Jesus says crazy stuff like that, he says immediately afterwards, for your Father in heaven sees it all, and he'll make sure you don't miss out. So if God is not watching, if God is not there, then this whole crazy style of living makes no sense at all. But Jesus says, we take power to give it away. The kings of the Gentiles, he said, look at them. The little tin pot kings that surround our country. Have you seen how they behave? They have their courts. They have their favourites. They have their dignity. They try to live with as much status as they possibly can. It shall not be so among you. And so he talked about his disciples taking power only to use it for others. Being leaders only to be servants. That's the way to use power. And Yoda himself, who was very young when this picture was taken, but this is about the time when he wrote the book, says this about Jesus, and because it's up there rather than down there, I can't read it without looking at the screen, so excuse me while I turn around. The church seeks to help form people who risk being peaceful in a violent world, risk being kind in a competitive world, risk being faithful in an age of cynicism, risk being gentle among those who admire the tough, risk love when it may not be returned, because we have the confidence that in Christ we have been reborn into a new reality. And that seems to me to catch the balance very well indeed. A risky style, a radically different style, a style that makes people look at us and say, that's crazy, why would you be that way? And a radically dependent style that says, I am doing this because God is shaping me into something different. He's changing my church into something different. And that's the way power has got to be used. We often measure somebody's power by, I guess, three criteria. They come up again and again. There's money, there's sex, and there's authority. If you want to know what status somebody has, you ask, how much does he earn? How much money has he got? And people who are powerful often flaunt the symbols of their success, don't they? Not just in public these days, but more and more over social media. And sex, too. What nice girl has this powerful man got on his arm? Has this preacher got a faithful wife and family behind him? And we tend to think about people's relationships with their partners or potential partners as another indicator of just how well they're doing in the power stakes. And then there's authority. Has he got the key to the executive washroom? Has he got a parking place with his number plate printed above it? How important is he? Who reports to him and who does he report to? And we use those as markers of people's success in gaining power. But Jesus talks about them all a little bit differently. With money, he says it's about how you use it, not about how much you've got. It doesn't matter what you've got. The Apostle Paul learned that lesson, didn't he? Wealthy Pharisee, to start with, came from a well-off family. But you find him writing to the Philippians, I know how to have a lot, and I know how to have a little. It doesn't matter, because my God is able to supply all your need according to his riches in glory through Christ Jesus. You see, radical difference, radical dependence at the same time. So money is there to be used, and we give it away in God's service. We use it to do things that wouldn't otherwise get done in a crazy, mixed-up, grasping, selfish world. And you have to ask about a Christian not just how much has he got, because that's irrelevant, but really, how does he use it? Second thing is sex. And in your relationships, it's about giving respect, not demanding gratification. You remember when Jesus was approached by the scribes and the teachers of the law one day, and they said to him, listen, there are two rabbis who've said profound things about divorce. One of them says you can divorce your wife for any reason whatsoever. The other one says divorce should be very, very difficult, if at all. What do you think? And Jesus sided with the strict one. He said, anybody who just puts away his wife like that commits adultery. And not just that, you cause her to commit adultery as well. Think about the repercussions for her. Think about what you're really doing. And his disciples were so staggered, they said, if it's that tough, there's no point in getting married. Because they were seeing marriage in terms of, what does it do for me? And Jesus was constantly talking about, how does it benefit both partners? How do you enrich other people by your relationships with them? I'll say a little bit more about that in a second, but let me just fill in the authority one here. And Jesus makes it clear, doesn't he, again and again, that when you've got authority, that authority is there so that you can serve others, not so that you can expect to be waited on yourself. And the greatest leaders are those who are servants. I've told this story at Belmont before, but one of the worst moments in my life was the day I met John Stott. You know, greatest Bible teacher of the 20th century, legendary evangelist, the man who built All Souls Langham Place into such an incredible church. A legend all around the world, John Stott. And I'd been invited to lead a course for sixth formers with him at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity, which he had created. And I went down with some notes which I'd had printed to be given out to the students. They were going to run them off for me just a couple of days before it started. And the girl at the reception desk said, oh, John, it is good to have you in this morning. John's here. Would you like to meet him? I'm like, John, stop. No, not ready. Let me straighten my tie. Oh, no. And without waiting for me to do any of the panicking bit, she just pushed a door behind her. It swung open. And I could see into a room in which John Stott was sitting with his Bible in the centre of a group of people who were having a group Bible study. And at that point, he looked up and said the most chilling, terrifying words I've ever heard. He said, John, we're just talking about the ministry of the women in the Bible. What do you think? Beam me up to heaven right now. It was so scary. But you know, I realized as soon as he said that, he really was interested. He wanted to know what I thought. And I found that was one mark of him. And when we did that course with the sixth formers through the next week, they came out with some silly, juvenile comments, as young people often do, and made judgments, sweeping generalizations, which just couldn't possibly be true. But John never lost patience with them. He was always interested in their opinion. He wanted to know what they thought. And he gave them confidence because they felt, here is somebody who, although he's a big name, he's a star, nonetheless, he's just here as an enabler. He wants to help us, and he thinks we're important. That, it seems to me, is what godly leadership is about. Using authority to serve others and not stand on your own dignity. Bill Hybels planted Willow Creek Community Church in the outskirts of Chicago 40 years ago, and he's just about to stand down. And two pastors have been appointed to replace him, one a man and the other, the senior pastor, a woman. And he and his wife talk about how they came to the point where they started to realise that women had something to offer in that role. And Hybels says this: "It's not easy for me to read Lynn's words." Lynn is his wife, and she'd explained how, as a woman, as the wife of a successful pastor, she'd always felt kept in the background, not able to develop in the way that she wanted to. She felt she had gifts that were not being used, and despite herself, she started to resent the fact that people kept on saying, "Oh, it's great that Bill's got you in the background behind him," because she felt, "God wants me out there, and I'm just not using what I've got." And as she described that, Hybel said, "It's not easy for me to read Lynn's words. There I was, committed to creating a church environment in which women were free to use their God-given gifts, and yet my own wife was frustrated to the point of despair. But I certainly didn't make it easy for her to break out of the old pattern and make new choices. Everything about my lifestyle supported the traditional model of marriage and pushed her into a subordinate role. Starting a church proved to be far harder than I had anticipated. So I was insanely busy, and the level of responsibility I carried at a young age produced continual and extreme stress. Anytime Lynn asked me to do even a small thing to help her, I felt burdened and impatient." That's Bill and his wife, by the way, on the first date when he took her home. They are 17 in that picture. There's a long married life ahead of them. And he goes on to say, "And of course, because of my visible ministry, I was applauded and honoured. Lynn heard again and again how powerfully God was using me. It's a good thing Bill has you serving behind the scenes," was a comment that repeatedly made her ask, "What's wrong with me? Why am I not content?" Clearly, freeing women to live out their God-given calling means more than simply rethinking theological views of women in leadership. It means valuing the contributions of all women, whatever their gifts. So that's the point I want to make. It's not about women in leadership. Think what you like about that. But the important thing is everybody needs to be enriched and nourished by one another. And that often doesn't happen. Lynn Hybels, by the way, obviously thinks that Bill did a bit more than he thinks he did, because when he'd been married for 40 years, she wrote this on her blog: "Along the way, you helped me discover and deserve boldness I didn't know I had, and I wasn't the only one. There were thousands of women at Willow and beyond who needed to hear a pastor say, 'You are an image bearer of God. You have gifts and passions and dreams that matter. The church and the world needs you to show up and offer the fullness of who you are.' Many of us still need to hear a pastor say that. I'm so grateful you've never stopped saying it." I'd like to give you some more examples of that, but we don't have time for this guy. Such a shame. I want to talk about Donald Trump. Let's have a look at Donald Trump for a minute. What would Jesus say to Donald? This is not an actual picture. Okay, fair enough. What would Jesus say to Donald Trump? We know about Trump. Massive corporate headquarters on Fifth Avenue, brought up in the lap of luxury, very proud of his family, many of whom are involved in his business. Somebody who's prone to make big claims about himself. This is the one he's making this weekend. He's done more in his first 9 months than any preceding president. Ooh, I'm not so sure about that. And here are some of the statements he's made, checked by a fact-checking site on the internet, which is pretty reliable, which he's got wrong. And in fact, if you look at his scorecard, he's true a very little part of the time. It's mostly true and half true more of the time. Mostly false statements come in a bit larger, and the largest body of statements he makes are purely false. The pants on fire character category is unusually high as well. And he's somebody who clearly says things before he's really thought about what he's saying. This is his famous tweet this weekend about the state of things in Britain today and why America's doing so much better. And he's liable, as we know, to take to Twitter at a moment's notice to the despair of those around him just because he can. And he says, "When somebody says something about me, I'm able to go bing, 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 and I take care of it." And he's talking about Twitter. Doesn't take care of it. He often gets himself in more problems, but he doesn't seem to notice that. And he's got a seamy side to him as well. His past life has been unfaithfulness, adultery, all kinds of stuff. And on a program with Howard Stern, the shock jock, a few years ago, he talked about his casual living and the way in which he risked AIDS again and again, and said, "I've been so lucky in terms of that whole world. It's a dangerous world out there. It's scary, like Vietnam, sort of like the Vietnam era. It's my personal Vietnam. I feel like a great and very brave soldier." What, for sleeping with women you didn't know? Unprotected? That makes you a very brave soldier. And that really sticks in people's throats because of, obviously, what he's said about this guy, John McCain, Republican senator who genuinely is a hero. 5 years in imprisonment after being shot down over Hanoi. As you see him in the picture there, being struggled out of the water by Viet Cong soldiers. He's broken one leg, broken one arm, and his hip is shattered in three places. He's going to receive no medical care, and for 5 years he's going to be in a terrible situation. He's written a memoir about it, which is grueling to read. He talks too about how he discovered the power of prayer in that 5 years, but that's another story. What's Trump said about McCain? He's not a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people who weren't captured. And Donald Trump, who dodged the draft himself, says some very silly things. So, what would Jesus talk about with Trump? Well, I think it's very simple. I think there are many things he would say, but here are three I'd pick out. First, powerful people need to be accountable. Just because you're the President of the United States doesn't mean you can tweet off and blast away at people in any way you want. You need to be accountable to others. And if we have power, that's not a license to do what we like. It's a warning that we should be accountable to somebody else, that other people need to shape and correct our course. None of us are on our own. Our life here is all about teamwork, is about people helping us become the kind of people we need to be. Jesus, I think, would talk to Trump about powerful people needing to be honest and open, about the fact that Trump keeps so many things to himself that he doesn't want people to know about. You need to be honest. You need to be clear. You can't just cheat on your wife. You can't just do deals which are dodgy with the Russians or whoever else. You need to be open. Because when people start to distrust you, that's when your power starts to be tarnished and becomes slightly less useful. Third, I think you would say powerful people need to be resilient. Why, Donald, do you need to prove all the time that you get bigger figures in the ratings than anybody else? That your share of the vote in the election was so far bigger than it actually was? That people love you out there? That you're going to do magic things that are going to sort out the economy and the medical system and everything else? Why do you need this? Why have you got this craving for people's attention and love and willingness to follow? There's something going on in there that you need to look at and sort out. Those are the kinds of things I think Jesus would say. Very quickly, though, let's have a look at Vladimir Putin. What would Jesus say to Vladimir? Well, we know a bit about him, don't we? He's got the highest approval ratings of any Russian president ever. That's the blue line at the top there. You can see it dips a little bit when Russia has an economic crisis, but he's way up higher than ever before. And part of that is his image. You're always seeing pictures of him like this in the Russian media. A lot has been made of his judo performing past, and he's a hard man, a strong man. And that, in some ways, is what Russians relate to. Here's one of Russia's latest generation of nuclear submarines. It moved recently from the Baltic round to the Black Sea, where it's anchored off Sevastopol. And it was followed carefully all the way, first by the Germans, then by the British, then by the Spanish. And all of the NATO countries followed it all the way around very, very carefully to see what it would do. It gave them the slip. And the first they knew of where it was when it was firing nuclear bombs at Syria. And that kind of thing the Russian public love. They feel they've lost their greatness over the last few years, and now Putin is standing up to everybody else. He's being a strong man. He's bringing it all back. He's not a communist either. What he says about communism is it was a blind alley far away from the mainstream of civilization. And he talks about the way in which we have to learn the lessons of the 1917 revolutions, which led into a period which was a mixed blessing for Russia. So he's not a communist. In fact, because of his Orthodox mother, he's a strong connection with the Orthodox Church. And you often see him worshipping in churches. Here he is in Jerusalem, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Jesus is supposed to have risen from the dead. Trump went in there and had a look around. Putin went in there and knelt down and prayed. And so he makes a lot of his religiosity. It's a particular kind of religiosity, and one of the things that's happening in Russia is that his church, the Orthodox Church, is being strengthened. 25,000 churches have been planted since he came to power, but others are the recipients of very strict laws that now won't allow them even to proselytize, to recommend their faith within their building or on the internet unless they get a permit from the government, which is never going to come. And so he's effectively silencing all rivals to his church. Another problem for Putin is the fact that his marriage has broken up. Mind you, that's not uncommon in Russia. I think 682 in every 1,000 of Russian marriages end in divorce. And the Orthodox Church looks on divorce a lot more kindly than most churches. And so just last year, or was it the year before? No, it was last year. He and his wife of 30 years announced that they were splitting up. That's okay, that's fair enough, but the rumours have emerged that he's having an affair with this woman and that she, in fact, has had a baby by him. And that's one of the problems with Putin. He's shadowy, he's aloof, he can do more or less what he wants. Resistors, protesters are cruelly treated, and there isn't freedom of speech in Russia. He seems to be doing well out of it as well. Here is part of a video on which one of his opponents has highlighted just one of the many mansions that have been built in his name. And he says in the video, "Don't let anybody deceive you. This is what real corruption is." And so Russia has become a much more corrupt country as a result of Putin's being in charge. He's struck deals with the big businessmen. Things go his way because it's his way of keeping an iron grip on the country. What would Jesus talk about with Putin? Well, again, I think three things. First of all, that strength isn't everything. The Russians love a strong leader, an Ivan the Terrible, a Peter the Great, a Catherine the Great, a Lenin, a Stalin. But it's not all about strength. And sometimes we show our power best when we channel it into the service of others in a way that makes us vulnerable and weak. Wealth isn't the point. Putin is doing very, very well indeed, financially, out of his ruling of Russia. But that's not what it's about. What you say about money is not how much have you got, but how are you using it for others? Listening isn't weakness. Putin is unprepared to listen to the opposition, unprepared to have a free press. He sees power as demanding a strong central grip on everything. I think Jesus would say it's only when you make yourself weak enough to listen to others that you learn real wisdom. So Jesus, power, and us. Finally, what's it got to say to us? Just 2 points and I'm finished. First of all, what does it say to us about the powerful people in our world? It says pray for them. I remember John Stott coming to Exeter when he was a good bit older, actually. His last book had just been published, and he hadn't written it. It was just a collection of bits from his previous books. And he and the Bishop of Thetford, who was an equally doddery old guy, were invited to go to St. Leonard's Church Centre and have a chat with some sixth formers. And these kids had never heard of John Stott, so when they saw these two old shaky men walking into the room, it was kind of... And they found after 5 minutes that John Stott's mind was as razor sharp as ever. And they asked some silly questions. This was about the time when Charles and Diana were having their problems and Camilla's name was beginning to be mentioned. And so one of them said in a very supercilious, I gather you're a royal chaplain. What do you think about what Prince Charles is getting up to? Huh? And John Stott shot straight back, I pray for him every morning, don't you? And you should have seen the guy's face. No, actually. Right. Aye. But absolutely right response. And 1 Timothy chapter 2 says we should pray, holding up holy hands for kings and all those in authority. Don't just criticize the powerful, but pray for them. What about our own power? Us and our own power? Serve. Timothy Keller said this, and with this I'm finished. The more the culture around us becomes post and anti-Christian, the more we discover church members in our midst sitting under sound preaching, yet nonetheless holding half pagan views of God, truth, and human nature, and in their daily lives using sex, money, and power in very worldly ways. It's hard to deny what Gary Parrott and J.I. Packer write. Superficial smatterings of truth, blurry notions about God and godliness, and thoughtlessness about the issues of living career-wise, community-wise, family-wise, and church-wise are all too often the marks of evangelical congregations today. Sound like Belmont? You judge. If it does in any way whatsoever, remotely, it's because we're not handling power the way we should. Let's now celebrate the ultimate powerful act that looked like weakness.